Welcome, everyone. My name is Zoe Laidlaw, and I work with Dr. Bader and Dr. Pearson, and I'm just really pleased that you're all able to join us this evening for an hour on affairs in couples therapy. It's a real honor to introduce Dr. Ellen Bader and Dr. Peter Pearson. Many of you have trained with them before, but since we do have a lot of new people with us this evening, I wanted to say just a few words about them. Pete and Ellen introduced the developmental model of couples therapy in a book they wrote in the 80s called In Quest of the Mythical Mate. That book earned an award from the California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists for its outstanding contribution to the field, and it's still used today in graduate schools and training programs across the country. And in fact, it's in its 14th printing. And as you know, the developmental model of couples therapy is now widely accepted as a cornerstone of couples therapy. So they were really pioneers in this field. And they've continued to be leaders and innovators, and they're always developing new tools and techniques and searching for ways to share them with other therapists. Which brings us to tonight's call, because here we are together on a teleseminar call. And, you know, doesn't that make you a bit like pioneers and innovators, too? I mean, this is kind of high-tech. I've pressed the mute button so that we won't hear any background noise while Pete and Ellen are presenting, but at some point they may ask for comments from participants, and I'll just push another button, and that'll make that possible for you all to share your answers. So I think that's it. Okay, Pete and Ellen, shall we begin?
Let's do it. Marie Chevalier once said that we pick our partners in dimmer light than we would ever pick our wardrobes. And in fact, the same is often true with affairs. People pick their affair partners very quickly and without often much awareness of the trauma that it may wreak in their primary relationship. In fact, the statistics say that less than 50% of all marriages are monogamous over the course of the marriage. Now, that's not the same as saying that half the marriages have an affair, because some people have three or four marriages and multiple affairs, but it's still a very high statistic, and it says a lot about why so many couples come to therapy to see us in the aftermath of an affair. So one purpose of our call tonight, actually, is to help you feel stronger, sure, more clear about where you plant your own feet when you're working with a couple and how you can take a leadership role helping the couple come to terms with the trauma and the aftermath of an affair. And what we're going to do tonight is to talk some about principles involved in how you assess an affair and also look at the different stages of treatment when you're working with a couple where there's been an affair. And when we speak about an affair, what we're talking about is when one partner secretly violates an actual or an implied expectation of the other's primacy.
Well, it's not just a challenge for the couple when there's an affair going on, because if you are like Ellen or if you are like me, you also find that it's a real challenge sitting in the office with a couple where an affair is going on, because you have to sit there with a lot of pain, and there's not a quick relief from the pain that's going on. Also, for a lot of therapists, it's not just a clinical issue, the idea of having an affair or the act of having an affair, but for a lot of therapists, it's also a moral and ethical problem as well. And in that sense, it often forces us to clarify what we really think and believe on the complexities of affairs and the different kinds of affairs, and to start getting clear on that within ourselves so we can help the couple sort through these really complex issues. Let me just start with a really overall view, from the balcony, so to speak, about couples' relationships in general and affairs in particular. It's a way of looking at relationships that helps me when I describe it to couples. It makes a lot of sense to them, and it makes the job of working with the couple a lot simpler, not necessarily easier, but simpler. And it's the idea that when two people get together and they form a committed relationship. Well, at the place where they, at the time when they form a committed relationship, what they are essentially doing is drawing a boundary around that relationship. And if you, and I tell couples, you can think of this boundary kind of like a bubble. And inside the bubble, it's really important to feel safe, psychologically and emotionally. And if both people can feel psychologically and emotionally safe inside that bubble, then it's much easier to support individual differences. It's easier to have disagreements. It's easier to have arguments. Because inside that bubble, they will learn how to repair ruptures when they happen and create this safety foundation. And then I go on and use another analogy, that a committed couple has so many interdependencies, far more than any other relationship we will ever be in. And because they have so many interdependencies, that at times it's almost like they are in a three-legged race, where what happens to one person profoundly affects the other person, just like that three-legged race. And it really doesn't do the partner in a three-legged race. It doesn't serve them well if one person is depleted, exhausted, depressed, and totally gives themselves up for the sake of the race. Nor does it serve a three-legged race couple well if one person says, okay, I'll be the boss, and you do what I tell you. In that situation, what you have is a pilot and a passenger instead of a pilot and a co-pilot. And if you just have a passenger in a long journey, when you hit a lot of turbulence, you really need a co-pilot, not just to help keep things steady, but also to help enjoy the journey together as well. And that seems to make sense to couples when I talk about that interdependency from that perspective. And then when it comes to the notion of affairs in particular, one of the bigger problems often is the person who has had the affair will start to downplay or minimize the effect of the affair on their partner and begin to talk about, well, just get over it. Let it go, will you? Let's just move beyond it. And I've looked for a lot of analogies to try to get the person who had the affair to really understand the importance of what they've done without minimizing it. And the analogy that I have come up with that seems to make the most sense and really get their attention, both people, is the notion of when two people create a startup company, that they talk about their dreams, what they want to create, what they want to do, how they want to be, and they each invest a lot if they're both committed to a startup company. And then when time passes and the company starts to struggle, and if one person discovers their partner has been embezzling and taking funds out of the company when it's been struggling, and that just throws everything into turmoil. Everything now is in question about whether or not we want to even maintain this company together. I can't really fire a partner. We have to find a way either to dismantle the company or to work it out. And the stakes are high because we've each invested so much. And sometimes it's even worse if the person who has done the embezzling has been taking funds and precious time and energy and investing it into a rival startup company. And that makes the pain even worse and the decisions even harder to figure out what to do. And it takes a long time to regain trust. If the person who's done the embezzling says to their partner, well, why don't you go home? I have to work late tonight and take care of some things. Or, it's been a long time, Terry, since you've had a vacation, so why don't you take a couple weeks in Hawaii, and I'll take care of things here on the home front. Everything that happens, even if it's intended as support and goodwill, gets put under the microscope of, what are they really trying to tell me? can I really relax when I'm gone? Can I relax when I'm on vacation or go home early and they're working late? Everything gets challenged. Everything is under a microscope. It takes a long time to regain that trust, to decide whether or not you're going to recommit your valuable time, energy, resources, and money to build anew or not. And that analogy seems to register with people who have had affairs and they try to deny the effect or the importance on their partner.
In fact, for many, it took a lot of soul searching to make the original commitment. And once they made the commitment, they believed it was a commitment for life. And then when the affair happens, all the years and all the effort are thrown up in the air. And in fact, I like to redefine it not so much as the reestablishing of trust, but the need to make a new decision about whether, in fact, we are a couple or aren't we, and whether we're going to put a boundary around the two of us as a couple again or not. And so I want to talk about some of the areas that I use to evaluate the meaning of an affair and that helps me figure out interventions that I can then feed back to the couple. And so there are several areas that I look at. I look at the historical evolution of the relationship, the developmental stage of the relationship at the time the affair took place, the individual dynamics of each partner, the timing of the affair, the type of affair, the length of the affair and the number of affairs, and the type of betrayal and the type of deceit. And I want to go through each of those a little bit more detail with you. When I look at the history of the relationship, I'm looking at how long has the couple been together? How did they originally form the initial bond, and how strong was the bond? Did they make a conscious commitment? Did they establish a strong commitment publicly in a wedding ceremony, or did they have a commitment that they made to each other for monogamy when they decided to live together? I'm also looking at the history of fidelity. Was this the first affair or not? And positive and negative aspects in the couple's history. But most importantly, I'm really trying to see the developmental stage of the relationship. And I believe strongly that affairs are a reflection of the developmental stage, and that frequently they occur in the context of failed differentiation. And I can't go through our whole developmental model tonight. I'm hoping that most of you are pretty familiar with it, but I'm going to highlight some of the most common places for affairs to take place. One of those is that you may have a long-term conflict avoidance symbiotic relationship in a couple. And over the years, each partner has avoided differentiation, avoided conflict, not addressed things directly with each other. And gradually, the relationship has eroded, and they live in a kind of quiet tension with each other. And in this case, an affair can be designed to create a crisis and, in fact, may represent an actual high commitment to the marriage or the relationship, but it's a crisis designed to disrupt a long-term symbiosis. Another common stage
for... Let me just make one more comment about a conflict-avoidant couple. And when I see a conflict-avoidant couple, and I will say this example to them, I'll say I had a couple in my practice one time. Both of them really, really avoided disagreements. And one time the husband, in a brilliant statement of self-awareness, said to his wife, he said, "You know, we don't fight, and you know that I don't like to argue or disagree. But the problem is that makes me an unsafe partner to be with. And the reason it makes me an unsafe partner is because you really don't know when I agree with you whether I agree because I want to do it or whether I'm agreeing just to avoid a conflict." He said, "Because of that, you really never know what my true values or beliefs or priorities are. And in that sense, it makes me an unsafe partner to be with." And she looked at him and she said, I really, really am glad you said that, because I've had this gnawing sense of unease between us, but I've never could put my finger on it, and you just nailed it.
A second common developmental stage for affairs to take place are what we call the symbiotic practicing couple. And this is the couple where one partner is wanting lots more independence and autonomy, and the other partner is trying to maintain the initial symbiotic relationship. And in this type of couple, frequently there have been failed attempts at differentiation on the part of the practicing partner, but they weren't able to hold on to their wants, their desires, and actively create a differentiation phase. And so they begin to pull away. And the affair can actually be had by either partner. The practicing partner may have the affair as a way of saying, I don't need you, I'm independent, I'm out in the world, I'm doing my own thing. But I've also seen couples where the symbiotic partner is the one who has an affair out of fear that they're losing the other. In one case, a male partner who had an affair with a woman who was dying of cancer, and he wanted to feel needed again, and so he moved in to take care of the woman who was dying. But in any case, I strongly suggest that you ask yourself, where is this couple's development arrested? Because that will be a primary part of how you frame the treatment. Another area that I look at is the individual dynamics of each partner and what is it about them individually that may have played a part in the affair taking place. In fact, do we have, for example, a narcissistic partner whose whole self-esteem is sexualized and they are repetitively looking for other partners to boost their ego? Do we have an unconscious replay of a family pattern when somebody comes out of a family where back through several generations there's history of affairs? We may have a passive-aggressive partner who expresses their anger sexually. The affair might be a homosexual affair and an experimentation and a desire to begin to acknowledge or come out as a homosexual. There's also often there can be early trauma and early history of sexual abuse that is being played out in some way in the affair that's taking place. So I'm looking for early script decisions and early personality structure to also tell me about the meaning of this particular affair. The timing of the affair is also critical, because often an affair represents some aspect of an existential crisis. So you could have the timing take place as somebody is really into midlife, they're aging, and they're afraid they're leaving things behind. Or the timing can be after the birth of a child, where the mother gets very attached to the infant, the father feels left out and goes and has an affair. It's not uncommon for affair to take place when one spouse is very ill. Or recently I worked with a couple where he was part of a startup company that was going public and was so involved in work, and she was feeling left out and angry that she was so left out.
It's interesting. I had a couple one time in my practice where he had an affair shortly after they were married, and in looking at his individual history, he really had never attached with anyone in his life. Got attached with his fiancée, got married, and then freaked because he thought he was going to lose his freedom, and gets mothered.
Another common time actually is when there's an unmourned death or an unmourned loss. And another man who had an affair after his mother-in-law died, and he was very, very close to his mother-in-law, and he saw the woman that he was having the affair with actually as a replacement for his mother-in-law. It can also be to ward off the depression of an empty nest or an empty marriage. I also look at the type of affair it is, and affairs can fall on a continuum from a very, very high commitment to the marriage, actually, to a low or lack of commitment to the marriage. And I want to see if I can begin to figure that out pretty early in the therapy. And often the partners who feel the most betrayed know that the affair symbolized a very low commitment to the marriage. And sometimes the partners who don't want to tell much or don't want to talk about it much may indeed have a high commitment to the marriage.
Either way, if we go back to the notion of a boundary or a bubble around the couple, I will tell the couple in the office that the affair is really an assault on that boundary. And it's a very powerful assault. It creates a huge injury in that boundary. And because of that, it takes a long time to repair it.
Some of the early decisions that somebody may have made as a child that can but get played out in an affair are things like, I'll get even with you, or sometimes the sneaky adolescent who likes to play you can't catch me, or I'll get what you won't give me. And often it's easier to sneak than it is to be self-defined. Another time for an affair to take place is when one partner makes a unilateral decision for no sex in the marriage and then denies the significance of this or denies that it should bother the other person. And they'll sometimes get touchy if the partner has feelings of loss or attraction for somebody else or who want even to talk about it, and they'll just say, no, I don't want to have sex and I don't want to talk about it.
Do you, Ellen, when you're working with a couple, do you help that couple clarify any combination of these reasons as you work with them?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only clarify them, but make them very explicit. And I'm looking to make it quite explicit, and we'll talk more about that as we get into the different stages of treatment. But a couple more areas just to move forward is that the length of the affair and the number of affairs is also pretty crucial. A quick one-night stand is a lot different than the person who's had multiple ongoing affairs, who may have a sexual addiction or who may have had an affair for many, many years that they hid and told a lot of lies around. And in fact, you also want to look at the type of betrayal and the type of deceit. It's very different. There's a continuum, I think, between an affair that took place with some unknown person far away and was probably more of a one-night stand, to an affair that took place with somebody that the spouse knows, and particularly when it's a best friend or a family member, it is extremely, extremely painful. Also, you have to look at, was the health of the spouse jeopardized? Did the person go to prostitutes or have a mistress, and what kind of safe sex or unsafe sex was involved? And what kind of injury is actually done to the partner? Sometimes there's herpes. Sometimes there's a child that comes out of the affair and the partner ends up having to support a child in another relationship. So there may be a financial implication to the affair. And I do want to look at the continuum of lies. So were there actually no lies? Were there lies of omission? Was there lots of lying and sneaking around? And even worse, were there repeated lies and denial even when the spouse guessed? So if the spouse guessed and asked questions and they're told that they're crazy and they keep on acting like it doesn't exist even when there's a lot of suspicion, then there's also an assault on the sanity of the partner. And I think there's a theory in transactional analysis of first, second, and third degree games. And looking at the severity of affairs, I think it can be a good way to look at it, because a first degree affair would be one that is like a one-night stand, where the partner may not tell, they may never tell, it may not interfere much with the marriage, and it really isn't that disruptive to the couple. A second-degree affair would be lots of deceit. It would involve perhaps an affair with a secretary, a best friend, a family member. And the third-degree affair would be the one that is life-threatening, that leads to financial ruin, pregnancy, or even at worst, a let's you and him triangle fight situation where somebody ends up dead. And in fact, there's an execution about to happen in California next week that has played out over, I don't know, I think it's 15 or 16 years, in which a man who's in prison about to be executed hired somebody to kill the woman who was involved with his lover so that he could have him all to himself. So you want to look at what is it, and I think, you know, sometimes it's interesting to look a little bit at Bill Clinton and the situation with Monica Lewinsky, because it represents a number of these things I've been talking about. Clinton seemed to have a family script that made him susceptible to having some sex with her. He had a predisposition historically to addiction, a life and growing up in a family with addiction. He had a lifetime behavioral pattern previously of some infidelity. And he had, in fact, suffered some losses just before his involvement with Monica. He'd lost his mother. He had been close to Ron Brown, a congressman in California who had died. Rabin in Israel had died. And he'd also just lost a lot of seats in Congress to the Republican Party. So, and then had a political comeback, which could have engendered some arrogance. And all this pulled, I think, helped pull Clinton towards Monica and towards his involvement with her. So you want to take all these issues into account as you think about, all right, what's the meaning of the affair and how am I going to talk to the couple about the affair? And now we want to go through some of the treatment issues when you're handling an affair. And it's helpful to me to think about it as an initial stage, a middle stage, and an ending stage, although sometimes the initial stage can go very quickly, and sometimes you don't get all the way to the termination stage because the couple decides not to come back.
So, Ellen, let me ask you a commonly debated question within the field. When a couple comes in and one person says the affair quite hasn't ended, do you make that person stop seeing the affair partner before working with them as a couple? Do you make that as a condition of working with them as a couple, or do you let things unfold the way they're just going to unfold?
I don't make that a condition, and I know that's a different position than a lot of therapists in the field. However, I do make a condition of honesty. And so if the person is having the affair and wanting to continue to have secrets and slip and slide around the primary spouse, then I don't want to work with them as a couple.
The other thing, too, is if you say to the person, you have to stop the affair before we can work together as a couple, there's nothing really to keep that person from lying to you, the therapist. If they're going to lie to their spouse, they'll lie to you as a therapist, and you really can't enforce the no contact with the other person if you're going to work with them as a couple. So trying to get that kind of promise is a little bit like saying to an alcoholic, you got to stop drinking before I'll work with you in treatment.
One thing I think, just before we launch into the different stages of handling an affair, that might be kind of fun to do is just think for a minute about all the different emotions that can propel somebody towards an affair. Things like revenge and just think for a minute. I'm going to ask Zoe to open up the line for a second, and just if you would say what comes to your mind in terms of feelings that propel people into an affair. Just go ahead, yell it out.
Scared.
Anger.
Lonely.
Hurt.
Grief.
Hurt.
Lonely.
Rage.
Insecurities.
Insecurities.
Resentment.
Adequacy.
Yeah,
helplessness,
longing,
out of control,
bored, grief,
yep.
Grief,
feeling controlled,
yep. Okay,
so you
think so?
Yeah, so you really are beginning to identify all the different kinds of emotions that are important to address when you're working with a couple underneath both sides.
So, in the initial stage of working with a couple when an affair has been revealed, it often starts out that they come in and it's like a crisis. And the affair has just been revealed. There's often a wounded or very upset party. Everything is up in the air. Everybody's upset. You may have somebody even be suicidal. And the first thing that I want to do is slow the process down and slow down the intensity of what's going on and confront the need to make impulsive, premature decisions about the marriage. The couple wants to know urgently what's going to happen now, and they want to just figure it out immediately.
What do we do about it? What do we do about it? What do we do about it is the common lament said with a lot of intensity.
And also, they often have distorted ideas about what led to the affair. So I want to ask them if they can go slow enough to understand the meaning of the affair, to understand what it had to do with either each of them as individuals or about the marriage, and so that they can make a truly informed decision about whether they want to stay or leave rather than an impulsive decision.
Now, here's the thing behind the impulsive decision, and it comes from the latest stuff on brain research, that the part of our brain that feels physical pain is the same part of our brain that lights up when we feel emotional pain. And there's a lot
of rejection.
There's a lot of emotional pain, and the urgency to make a decision is basically being driven by a desire to get relief from the pain. That's what they're seeking. And so it's almost, you're not giving them good news by saying it's important to slow down so that we can understand it, because what they want to do is get relief from the pain as soon as possible.
So as part of handling that immediate threat, is there will be a need to clarify what will happen right now. So they'll be asking you to help them with, is the affair over or isn't it? Are they going to live together or are they going to separate? And so part of that initial stage is clarifying some of those kinds of decisions and actively controlling the communication in the office so that they don't escalate and so that you can help them make a thoughtful decision about whether they can stay in the same house or not, if there's children involved, how to tell the children. And as part of that initial beginning, I want to be able to define some of the individual issues that contributed to the affair, and particularly the developmental arrest in the couple that probably led to the affair. Because in doing that, then I can help them take a look at, okay, this is what the nuts and bolts of therapy are going to be about. I also, as part of the initial stage, want to clarify a confidentiality agreement. And after a lot of soul searching, what I've decided to do is that I give the couple the choice, because I do frequently have some individual sessions in the context of couples therapy. I don't do long-term ongoing individual therapy with any partner, but I like to know what's going on. I like to have the truth and the information. And so I give the couple the choice. Do the two of you want to have me have the ability to keep things in confidence when I see you separately, or is everything available to be communicated when we're back together again? And just having them wrestle with the issue of confidentiality can be extremely revealing and, in fact, can determine whether or not they choose to continue in treatment.
It really takes you out of making that decision for them and puts they have to wrestle with that conundrum on their own. And do you help them work through that solution in the office?
Sure. I mean, I help them come to terms with it and make a decision. And that's even part of some beginning differentiation work, if they're in different places about it. I also was supervising a case not too long ago where I thought the female partner in the couple where there was an affair did a very interesting thing as part of the initial stage of treatment. Her husband had lied to her twice about involvement with the same woman. And he really, really wanted her to be in therapy with him, his wife. He wanted to rebuild the marriage, he said. And she felt extremely untrusting. And he was very, very adamant about and crying and saying, I want to be with you. I want you to take this risk and come to therapy and let's work it out. So she said to him, you're asking me to take a big risk. And in fact, at the moment, I don't think you're such a good risk. So I'm going to ask you to risk also. She said, what I'd like to do is have you and I sign an agreement where we will be in therapy. We will be in therapy as long as it takes to rebuild our marriage. But if I find out that in the course of our therapy, you have met with her, gone out with her, seen her again, that we will have an agreement in our, that our financial settlement will be 60-40, that you will get 40% of our finances and I will get 60%. And on those terms, I will participate in the therapy, and otherwise I won't. It was an interesting way for her to approach the risk issue. It also did what she thought it might do, which he said, if that's the case and that's the way you want to do it, I realize that I'm going to go off with the other woman and I don't really want the marriage. So it brought that to light very quickly. So let's move on to the middle stage of therapy. And in the middle stage of therapy, you really are focusing on each of the individual issues and helping partners see what they've projected onto one another that may have led to a significant contribution to the affair. You're looking at particular transferences that they may have to each other. I saw a new couple recently, for example, where she was the one who had an affair, and her husband said, he kept saying, but she's so strong, she's so strong, she's so much stronger than me, I'm the one who's vulnerable. And in fact, she was quite vulnerable. She'd had several deaths in her family in the last 2 years before this. She was actually a woman who was afraid to acknowledge her dependence on him, and yet she wanted to be nurtured and wanted a lot of emotional sustenance, and he couldn't see that at all.
Let me just make a comment about the transition. The first part of the first stage of therapy is it moves into more individual work. And one of the common dilemmas that therapists have is sitting in the office and the spouse is just railing and beating on the person who had the affair. And the person who had the affair sits there and basically, at least at first, they believe like they should take it, be a good sport. This is part of the atonement for it. And what I do is I talk to the couple about when you express your anger, and I say anger really is it's a feeling that results from an injury or a mistreatment, and anger usually shows itself in a desire to hit out at somebody or something else. And underneath that anger, there's always distress or sorrow. And the other aspect of anger that I will tell couples is that it's also a medical term, which is used to describe an inflamed sore or wound. And the desire to hit out is a natural reflex under anger. But I will tell the couple there's a difference between anger and wrath. And wrath is a really deep indignation about righting a wrong, but it gets expressed as a desire to punish the other person. And a lot of times what goes on in the office is a lot of wrath. And what the spouse does is want to inflict damage on the other person for the amount of pain that they have felt. When that wrath continues, what you're basically doing is traumatizing the partner. And now they got two problems. Each are being traumatized by the other person. So it's not just let it out, it will help. But start making the distinction between wrath, the desire for revenge and punishment, versus expressing the pain that's underneath the anger. So that you don't have to believe or tolerate the expression of wrath. It just re-traumatizes.
Long ago, I heard a panel of a number of experts in the field, and the focus of the panel was, what do you believe made a difference with couples who successfully worked through and resolved an affair? And what the panel seemed to agree on was that one of the deciding differences was that there was, in fact, the capacity for the hurt partner to be able to express some of the hurt and anger, but to do it in short, time-specific chunks, and that there were clear boundaries around the time and space for that with the other person listening. And in fact, in the middle stage of treatment, for those of you who are familiar with our work using the initiator-inquirer process, this is a really a crucial place to be able to use that, because one of the core ideas in the initiator-inquirer is that you really take turns, and that the initiator, in fact, does have the opportunity to at times regress and express what either they're wanting to know or what they're feeling, with the other person, with the help of the therapist, getting a grip and being able to respond in a compassionate, empathic way. And in fact, both people do have such significant issues when an affair has traumatized the couple that they do need time and the safety of the therapy space to be able to bring those out into the open and work them through.
It's beginning to recreate safety within that bubble and boundary again.
And in fact, I like to talk about the issue of obsessing about affairs and the details. And particularly I'm talking about the out loud obsessing and the wanting to know and the asking a lot of questions and the not letting it go. And there is some aspects of that that are extremely valuable if it's done well, and there are some destructive elements of that as well. The value of it is that if a partner is able to ask questions and get some answers, it reestablishes the broken boundary around the primary couple, and it will put an end to the deception and the feeling of craziness. What it does is it shifts the secrecy from the affair partner back to the spouse, where the spouse is now the one who knows what went on. It's also an opportunity to stop projection and blown-up distortions. So, for example, often a question people want to know, were they good-looking? Was the sex fantastic? And they can find out sometimes that, no, in fact, the sex was not all that fantastic, or it wasn't what you had imagined it to be. It also helps them create a meaning together, a shared meaning of what it was that enabled the affair to take place in the context of their marriage.
Let me add a P.S. about the obsessing, which is, I will go back to the analogy again of a startup company, where if a startup company is having a lot of problems, it makes only good sense for somebody to spend a lot of time thinking about how are we going to meet the payroll, how are we going to increase sales, what are we going to do about our marketing, that it's almost impossible for a person to be confronted with a significant challenge and not reflect on it in terms of what it means, what can be done about it, what are the real problems. So I try to reassure the obsessing partner that they are not crazy for having these thoughts that are so intrusive and obsessive, and reassure the partner who had the affair that this is just a natural process when you're faced with a crisis, that you just think a lot about what is the meaning of what's going on and what happened, especially if somebody did the embezzlement.
Often by going through that process, the partner or the spouse of the one who had the affair begins to really understand that it was not a personal injury or a personal insult. I mean, sometimes it is because it was meant for revenge, but many more times it was not personal and is much more a reflection of the inability in the couple to be honest, to be overt, to be direct with each other. And it gives them a way of working through.
Yeah, you really aren't responsible if your partner embezzles. It's their ethics, their morality, their behavioral decisions. It's how they responded under pressure.
Now let's look at what obsessing about the affair and the details about it does not accomplish. Because if somebody is just fixed on that type of obsession, it may keep them very distant from their own issues. It may keep them from wanting to look at the fact that they may be what we call a lie invitee. And we've written a lot about that in the Tell Me No Lies book. The lie invitee is the partner who can't handle anything direct and, in fact, clobbers the partner when they are direct. And sometimes the obsessing partner would like to continue that pattern, which makes it impossible for the other one to be straight with them.
It's as when the person has the affair, begins to get more vulnerable about what's going on, why they had the affair, etc., and then they get verbally or emotionally smacked by the spouse because they don't like the answer, or the answer might create the potential for more intimacy than they're able to handle.
The obsessing may support a kind of self-righteousness and a continual focusing on the other rather than the self, and it may keep a persecutor-victim dynamic going on. Now, I want to mention also the issue about what information that somebody who is looking for facts or information, I think, makes a lot of sense. Because obviously, if you go into too many details about all the aspects of the sex, that can be even more traumatic. But I think it is legitimate when a couple is putting the boundary back around the two of them to know who the affair was with, the extent of the emotional involvement, whether or not all contact has ceased, including cyberspace, and the extent of the sex, how frequent, not the actual aspects of it, but how often did it happen? Was it protected or unprotected sex? And was how much deception was used to arrange the meetings? I think they also want to know who else knows about it and why the desire for the affair existed. And it's this information that helps a partner decide, do I want to grieve the marriage and get a divorce? Or am I grieving really the loss of symbiosis and the loss of perfection and idealization that I had, or maybe the sense that I could put unbounded trust in somebody else and not realize what might happen? Or is the information helping me to challenge myself and to develop and grow and work on my own ambivalence about going or staying and helping me answer the question, can I stay with integrity?
See, essentially, working with not just a lot of couples' issues, but especially with couples where there's been an affair, it's really involves a whole pyramid of skills, developmental processes, developmental attitudes, and it's not something that can be just solved as a problem because it is an entire pyramid of skills and attitudes, and I tell couples this, which is why we can't solve it all at once or with one solution.
I thought I would share one thing. This is a little bit of a tangent, but when my daughter was 11 years old, she had, in school, they were given an assignment and everybody got a feeling and they had to write their own definition of a feeling word, and she happened to get the word jealousy. And she wrote what I thought was a fabulous definition of jealousy, and it's one that I use with couples often in an affair situation. She said, jealousy is when someone gets something that you want. You act like you want to get back at them, or you act angry around that person. Sometimes it can be solved, sometimes it can't. But when you are jealous, you usually aren't capable of other good feelings. You spend your time and energy trying to get back or trying to forget about what just happened. Now that's jealousy. I thought that was really good, the way she put it. So let's talk a minute now about the termination stage.
Let me say one more thing about the either beginning or middle phase of treatment, and it's an intervention that I have found exceedingly useful for not just couples where there's been an affair, but for a lot of couples in general. And that is, I will ask them to start describing the kind of relationship that they want to create or be in. And what does this really look like, the kind of relationship they want to create or be in? And the second part is, what kind of partner do you need to be or to become in order to bring that relationship about? And the real work, I say, the toughest work is lining up our integrity to be the partner we need to become to bring about the relationship we want. I will go on to say to them that the reality is most couples will spend more time trying to figure out what movie to go to or what restaurant to go to instead of spending that time trying to figure out just what kind of relationship do I really want to be and what kind of partner do I need to become to bring that about. Under high stress, under fights or argument, we get immediate clarity about how we want our partner to be when times are tough or in a difficult discussion. We rarely spend time trying to understand the kind of partner that we need to be in order to bring this relationship about. Couples will often start by answering the question of the relationship they want to be. They say, well, I want one that's happy or loving. Well, I say, that's great. That's like saying to a travel agent, well, I want to go on a vacation that makes me feel good or relaxed or re-energized. And if you're just willing to give a blank check to the travel agent and let him push whatever he happens to be promoting at the moment, good luck. We're going to have to do more work than that because the reality is it's really not an easy question to wrestle with. What kind of relationship do you want to be in? What kind of partner do you need to be to bring that about? Now each person is confronted with their own integrity rather than finger-pointing or having a checklist of things to do that their partner needs to become in order to have a better marriage.
Okay. A man said to me near the end of therapy, and I liked what he said. He said, the most important thing that you said to me in the course of our work together was that I wasn't going to be able to evaluate and make a decision about the future based on the past, but I was going to be able to evaluate it by how much I could trust both me and her to bring up issues and by the persistence we each showed in resolving them, and that in that way I would be able to come to my own determination by how much risk each of us were willing to take. And that leads into the termination stage, which is the time when I think the couple really can make a much better decision about whether to stay together or separate. It's at this stage that new agreements are negotiated and they can renegotiate a monogamy commitment or an honesty commitment. And it's also at this stage that I think both forgiveness and apology often take place. Forgiveness meaning not that it won't be a painful piece of the couple's past, but they really have moved beyond any vengeance and any bitter rage or thoughts of getting back at or getting even. It doesn't mean forgetting. An apology that is heartfelt on each side, an apology that really addresses the embezzlement. It addresses the reality of what went wrong. And when I was finishing with one couple, he kept saying to me, there's something missing, I'm not sure what it is, but I don't feel quite finished. And she came into a session and she said, I know what's not finished. She said, I haven't really said to you that I don't like myself, the part of me that was so dishonest with you, that hid so much and snuck around. And I've never said to you, that's not congruent with the kind of person or partner I want to be. And I think that you need to know that I don't respect myself for that, and it's been hard for me to look at myself and say that to you.
See, let me just add a PS to that. When I talk to couples about, and often in the office, describing or defining the kind of relationship they want to create, how they want to be as a partner, and then what will get in their way of becoming the kind of partner that they aspire to become, that is an easier entree then into the individual intrapsychic issues that can go way back into their early childhood attachment issues. And the other thing just around treatment is if you don't utilize EMDR or some of the other energy psychology approaches, emotional freedom techniques, Be Set Free Fast with Larry Nims, those are really good to help people overcome earlier trauma that preceded the affair or the trauma that has accompanied the affair.
Okay, two last things as we get close to wrapping up. One is in the last two slides for your handouts are just an example from a real case of how if you sit down and you're evaluating one of your own cases, you can ask yourself, what's the current behavior? What are the feelings that are being activated? What is the developmental stage and what is the intrapsychic, primary intrapsychic component? And if you sit down and do a slide like this on each partner, it will make you enormously more centered in terms of your own interventions and the mirror that you keep holding up to them about what they need to work through and about the shifts that are going to have to happen if they're going to be able to put it back together. I also wanted to mention two references. Janice Spring's book, After the Affair, is a wonderful book for partners to understand better the process that's involved in working through. And I also think that our book, Tell Me No Lies, is good because what we do in that book is we follow two couples, one who develops a very effective process of differentiation and what that looks like, and a couple who had repeated examples of failed differentiation, which finally resulted in the breakup of the marriage through a combination of some affairs and a mistress.
There's one more resource, which is on our website. If you go to couplesinstitute.com, there where it says resources for therapists on a splash page, there's a document in there about how to get the most out of couples therapy. And I have couple, and it's what I give to couples sometimes before they come in or very early in treatment. And it's a really good document to help couples think about relationships and help them to focus and get more organized around important things to look at instead of finger-pointing when they come into therapy. So it's a good thing to give to your couples if you want as another resource that's free that you can give them.
Let me interject something about that, since sometimes people have had trouble finding that on our website. If you're looking for that article, you follow the arrow to the therapist. It seems like it would be on the couple side of the site, since it's written sort of for couples, but it's on the therapist side of the site under articles. And that's where you'll find it.
You can also ask your couples to go to the website because we do articles once a month for couples that I write, and I write articles on passive-aggressive behavior and what it means to live with integrity and the struggle to do so. And then I talk about Krispy Kreme and my relationship and my struggle with Molly, et cetera. So there's good articles for your couples to check into as well.
Zoe, I'd love for you to open it up just to get very fast one or two people's feedback, how the call's been for you tonight.
I have a question.
We'd love some feedback.
Fabulous.
Fabulous.
Great.
Really
very helpful.
Packed and powerful. Good information.
Well organized.
Excellent. I look forward to seeing if the notes save all the information for me.
Okay.
Helpful, but my issue has not been addressed in any of this.
Part two.
Okay.
Is this in print anywhere?
One of the things, you want to mute it out again for a minute, Zoe? One of the things we're thinking about is possibly doing a Q&A kind of call in a few weeks where we go deeper into some of these issues. But this way we've all got a broad brush on some of the ways that we think about affairs.
And can help you get oriented with concepts and principles about how to deal with this hugely complex problem of affairs.
And I'm sorry we couldn't answer specific questions tonight, but we decided to do the principles instead.
Pete and Ellen, would it be appropriate to invite people to email questions to us? Not that we can answer them all, but it would give us an idea of what some helpful future topics might be.
Sure. It would be great if you all would, anybody who would like us to do a Q&A or go more in depth, send us questions.
Or what you would like to see more in depth that we didn't cover tonight, and what would be helpful in terms of your own individual take on how to work with the fairies and why it's challenging.
Yes, because I did hear someone say that her question was not answered, and so I'm sure that lots of you have other questions and you know, specific situations about the cases that you're working with, and obviously we couldn't cover it all in an hour.
But yeah, go ahead and email and we
right.
will.
So you can email to admin@couplesinstitute.com. And definitely for more resources to improve your work with couples, whether it's related to affairs or some other aspect of couples therapy, please visit our website. That's www.couplesinstitute.com.
And thank you all so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. This has been a grand experiment. Ellen and I are trying new things. I'm glad that you guys are willing to try new things. And so we appreciate your feedback and support. Thank you a lot.
Good night.
And
good night.
Night.